Hey, what's going on? My name is Rob, and this is another episode of Film Streak. And what we're doing with Film Streak is every episode, I'm watching a new film, something that's new to me, at least. I've seen a lot of movies, right? But there are plenty that I haven't seen, and there's new ones coming out all the time. So this is my effort to try and watch as much as I can, as much new stuff, and even catch up on stuff that I've been meaning to watch for a while, or just things that I've ignored. Maybe they've been recommended and I just kind of put it off or whatever. So that's what Film Streak is. And if you're listening to this, if you've heard other episodes, thanks for checking this out. Thanks for sticking along with the ride. Appreciate everybody who's listening. And let's get started with this episode. And by this episode, I mean, I want to do something different. We're in October now. So to me, October is the time for horror movies. It just is. You're building up to Halloween. It's like a whole thing. Let's just take the whole month and really get into it, get into the groove. And so here with this episode, I wanted to do some interesting pairings, I guess. So let's pick up where we left off. Film Streak is now at 135. 135 movies I've watched now, and more. But 135, this is Last Night in Soho. Baby,
you don't know what you say. So what brings you down then?
On the top floor.
It's perfect. I love it. Mind is not. If I could live any place and any time, I'd live here, in London, in the 60s. Something in my dreams. There was a girl.
And you are?
Sandy.
I got this kind of gift. I can see people, places, things others can't.
This is the closest most people ever get to their dreams. La 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 la
la la la la la la la la. They're not just dreams.
Jack, I don't want to do this.
You think you can just walk away?
It really happened.
What did you see?
Leaving ghosts.
I want to report a murder.
You witnessed the murder last night, but you believe this was a vision from the past.
The guy that killed her is still out there. I have to stop him.
Where are you going?
I know what you did.
I've done a lot of things. You can have to be more specific, love.
Okay, so this film is one that I was super interested in watching when it was announced and in production, because this is written and directed by one of my favorite contemporary directors, filmmakers. Someone who's just got a really interesting style and vision and a real master of technique, if you really think about it. But Edgar Wright just has a real touch for creating not just drama, but action and even comedy and suspense. He's just really a modern master of the form. So Last Night in Soho was a film that I was really looking forward to, and yet at the same time, because of COVID and pandemic issues, I seem to remember that it just got delayed and it seemed to get pushed back, and it was to a point where you even wondered if it was going to come out. And so now that the film has been out and I've finally gotten a chance to see it, it's been an interesting watch. Just knowing all the background behind the film itself, much less what the film is about and what the end result is. So I'll say this, you know, there's part of me that sees a lot of what Edgar Wright has done in the past and feels like some of it is homage to American filmmakers or American films. Some of it is even really kind of trying to break ground in American film. You know, Baby Driver, I felt like, took what I consider a very American genre or type of story, the car chase, heist, crime drama, thriller, comedy, whatever, and just cranked it up to 12 and did things and showed us things that we'd never seen before. And the way it incorporated music and the editing, it was just really an amazing experience to me. As someone who loves that particular type of film, to see someone really push the envelope and do some new things with it. And so here it is a distinctly British film and story. It's set in London and it's about someone, you know, a young woman who is growing up kind of, I guess, in the outskirts. You know, I'm not familiar with all of the areas of London and so forth, but it's clear about, you know, this is basically a country girl that moves to the city to pursue her education and a career in fashion and fashion design and that kind of thing. And yet, you know, gets hit with, you know, classmates and people there that kind of look down on her, kind of, you know, just kind of smirk at her. And yet at the same time, the pressure of that, of kind of jumping into that environment feet first and maybe not really knowing how to maneuver through that, also compounded with the external the external elements of the world around her and maybe some mystery about what she's really getting into. All of that just really mixed into something that I wasn't quite expecting, you know. This really turned into much more of a horror film than a kind of a fish out of water psychological drama. There are elements of that in this, but there are also elements that are straight out of horror films. I feel like there's a lot of like small little homages and tributes to, you know, films from the 60s and 70s, some of the shot choices and just some stylistic touches that I feel like, yeah, I see that. That's awesome. You pull in from the masters and making something that fits within your story. It doesn't stand out as being shoehorned in. It really works with what the story is that he's trying to tell. And so this young girl, she kind of gets into this situation where there may be some entity or some mystery of maybe there's a go. It's kind of hard to explain. You have to watch it, but it's high on style. Because it does involve a little bit of it's not a time travel story, but there is like elements that this character finds herself back in the 60s. And the production design, the music, everything is just, you know, top notch. But it's also very, it transports you to the era just so seamlessly. And that's the idea, because that is what this character is feeling. And so with that in mind, I thought this was just a really well done film. I mean, it's amazing in so many ways, in terms of its production, in terms of the characters and the performances. I thought they were all great. You know, the only downside or the thing that really doesn't work for me is it's a little hard to understand this world. And not understand it, but just to relate to it. You know, we're talking about a very specific story about a very specific type of environment that not a lot of American audiences are going to be familiar with. Let's put it that way. The situations, sure, we can relate to, but there's so much that is very dialed into that part of the world and that London in particular that It takes a little work to get there on the part of the viewer, if you're not familiar. But once you are, and you really understand, it's more about the emotions involved and the characters and the dilemma they're facing. Okay, now you're on board. So there's just a little bit of a hurdle, but once you get into it, you really go for the ride. It's really great. I really enjoyed it. Now, it's not necessarily one of my favorite Edgar Wright films. You know, I personally still think I like Shaun of the Dead. I like Hot Fuzz. I think The World's End is probably the best for me. And that's just because of me in particular, the point of life I'm at, that really kind of spoke to me in some different ways. Also the time that it came out, it just really matched up for me. Now, if I watch it today, maybe I'll feel different, but that's the one that really, really works for me. So this is a little bit different. And it's very specific, and I could see there being another version of this film where it's much more leaning into the horror aspects, maybe even more gory and graphic. But I could also see another version of this where it leans into the dramatic side, where the, let's say, supernatural elements aren't so pronounced or even part of the story. And I think it could still work. That's just how well it walks the line to me. So that's a recommendation. Check it out, especially if you're an Edgar Wright fan. And if you are, you probably have already seen this. It's my fault that I just really put it off and hadn't gotten around to it. But I'd recommend it. I'd probably watch it again just because I know there are so many details, so many little Easter eggs and little treats built into everything he does. That I'm sure I'll find more and see more and appreciate more on another viewing. So that is Last Night in Soho. Now let's move on. Let's keep this going. On that same note, let's get to 136, and this is The Neon Demon.
I see 20 or 30 girls come in here every day. From small towns with big dreams. Some girls crack under the pressure. You're going to be great.
What's it feel like to walk into a room? It's like in the middle of winter. You're the sun.
It's everything. You know what my mother used to call me? Dangerous. You're a dangerous girl. She was right. Dangerous.
And now for me, for my money, this is a little bit of a similar story and a little bit of a similar premise, but and also by a filmmaker who has a very distinct style and some signature moves that are unmistakably his own. The Neon Demon, directed by Nicholas Winding Refn. It's such a bizarre, surreal, magical, disturbing watch. It's hard to say it's a recommendation. I'll just cut right to it. But just for the experience of it, I would recommend at least watching it once. You may find it's not for you. But it's definitely an experience. And so just to kind of get to the basics of it, it is a similar thing. There's a young girl who's trying to get into the world of modeling. And in Los Angeles, it's a very kind of cutthroat culture and industry. And, you know, there's a lot of, there's a lot more mood building in this than something like Last Night in Soho. You know, that's really more of a, it's a whirlwind of experiences and feelings and emotions. And this is just very calm and cold and almost detached. And there's something to be said for that. That there's a power to that. And this film, this story, uses it in some pretty smart and pretty unsettling ways. You know, the only issue I really have with the film, just overall, like just the big takeaway, is that the main character is played by Elle Fanning, who, you know, I guess also Dakota Fanning's sister started as a young actor and has, you know, matured into a very, you know, talented and diverse actor herself. But this role and this character, I just felt like this really wasn't maybe the right. I couldn't quite buy this. And it reminds me of, you know, in a previous episode, I talked about the movie Cherry with Tom Holland playing, a young man who, you know, it covers a significant portion of his life. He's, you know, going to the military, comes home, he gets into trouble, robbing banks, he goes to prison. It's pretty big span of someone's life. And Tom Holland just really, I think he has the chops, but it's just hard to see past some of the other elements and maybe the external, like, expectations you have. At least it was for me. And so I couldn't really buy him in that part. And it's the same thing here, really. This film, this character is the demand here is that this character has to be so able to navigate the pressure of trying to enter this world of modeling, not being familiar with it, not really understanding how things work, and yet is all of a sudden like a runaway success, and people see something in her, and she becomes a bit of a hot commodity. And starts to believe her own hype. And so, it's hard to really buy that she makes that turn. And it's through the course of the story that, you know, other events are happening and other characters are moving around her. But still, it's a little bit of a stretch that it doesn't quite seem like she makes the turn. It seems like the film kind of takes her with it versus following her on that journey, if that makes sense. It's a strange way to put it, I guess, but it didn't really sit right with me, and I couldn't really peg what it was until thinking about it some more. And I just think it's maybe just, I can't see this actor in this role, or at least I feel like I see what the idea is. This is a character who starts out kind of plain, kind of naive and green, and becomes very savvy very quickly, to the point where she turns things on their head, whether it's how she deals with other people or how she deals with herself and how she moves through the world. All of that really seems to flip really fast. And, you know, it gets into like where there are consequences and things get dangerous. And so that's interesting right there, but I just didn't see this character really doing it. I felt like the story was I felt the filmmaker doing the work versus the character doing the work. And, you know, that's real artsy fartsy examination of this, because otherwise there's a ton of style in this film that is, to me personally, is very intriguing, very appealing. Like, I like the style of filmmaking. I like everything about the use of color, the use of light. I mean, it's so distinct. And Nicholas Winding Refn, if you've seen any of his other films, Drive is probably the most kind of commercially recognizable film that he's done, I think, to date. But that is very conventional compared to this. You know, if you've seen something like Only God Forgives, which I did not like on first viewing, but subsequent viewings, I've come around to. I've really understood more about what he was going for there. And there's even a TV series that he put together that's on Amazon Prime. It's called, Too Old to Die Young? I think that's what it is. Miles Teller, and it deals with LAPD and Mexican cartels and all kinds of, you know, wild stuff. But it's not maybe presented in the way you would think. It's very slow paced. It's very patient and very calculated. And so, like I said, it's a very distinct style. If you know that, then you kind of know what you're in for. If you don't, this is going to be a little bit of a acquired taste. So it's a recommendation for at least one viewing. After that, you decide if it's for you or not. A lot of you may say, oh, this is a pass. I can't even make it through the whole movie. I don't even understand what's going on. Fine. That's cool. That's all good. But that is 136. That is The Neon Demon. All right. So that's that first pair. I wanted to do a couple of pairs. Let's call them double features if you want. That related to, you know, newcomers in fashion and that kind of industry. It's a little bit glitzy, but with sprinkles of horror and suspense and some somewhat disturbing stuff in there. Okay. Here, let's get to some more here. This is 137. This is La Llorona.
Lo que se quedó atrás está atrás.
¿Pensás en eso? Que no te afecte.
¿Oyó a alguien llorar?
Los sirvientes se quieren ir. Todos tienen miedo.
Este encierro nos está enfermando.
Mi papá a ti te contaba todo.
Te prohíbo pensar eso.
Es una invasión. ¿Cuándo nos irán a dejar en paz?
Now, this is an interesting film that I actually heard about a few years ago. You know, I do know that this was screened and it made the festival circuit back in, I think, 2019. You know, a film festival that I work with here where I'm at actually screened this film. And that's the first time I had heard of it. And it's funny because also that same year or shortly around the same time that this was doing the festival rounds, there was another film that was released like in theaters and made, you know, actual broad release called The Curse of La Llorona or something like that. That is not this film. That is not a great film. I'll just say that. This one, on the other hand, this is a very interesting film because it's taking this, if you're not familiar with La Llorona, it's a, I guess, a Latin American folktale, folklore. It's a myth, let's say. And, you know, depending on what part of either Latin America or even, you know, here in some parts of America, Mexican-American community, there's different maybe iterations or versions of this story, but they're all primarily the same. And that is a story of a woman who loses her children, and she cries for them out of grief and sorrow and anger. And she cries for them, and that cry kind of haunts the living. And it's a thing where, you know, parents or, you know, people would use that to kind of keep little kids in line. You know, like if you don't behave, La Llorona is going to get you. So, you know, you would hear crying or like sobbing or something, or, you know, it's just one of those things that it's really kind of it's just a folk tale, but it's based actually in the idea of real trauma and grief. And so this film, it really kind of backs into that. It doesn't start out as that. And it's interesting because this is a film that is a Spanish language film. It's directed by a filmmaker, Jairo Bustamante, who is a Guatemalan filmmaker. And I think that's how you say his name. I'm guessing. Pretty sure. Hopefully. And because he's from Guatemala, I believe that was kind of the way to get into this story, is starting it not about the folktale or the legend or whatever, but starting it about the real world situation that's happening in Guatemala. And that is basically just a type of genocide that is happening there, and a civil unrest that is happening there. And so this film starts off with a retired general or commander who is on trial for genocide and war crimes against the Mayan, the indigenous people there in Guatemala. And it's not clear, like, how are we going to get to this story of this ghost? And as the film goes on, it's really a slow burn thing that it's all about building dread. So it can seem like it's a little bit of a political or even a family drama, because there's this whole court proceeding and this hearing and this trial. And when the verdict comes down and there are protests because the ruling is that there was no genocide committed. So now there's like civil unrest in the country, and this home, this man who's on trial, he's being just, you know, the pressure of a country against him now is building, right? And it's building against him, his family, and also the real internal conflict, the guilt, the remorse that he can't even acknowledge. It is inside of him, and it's manifesting itself in this presence. His servants, his you know, housekeepers and all this, they leave. They're like, we can't do this. We can't be a part of this, or this is all too much going on around here, so we're out. Well, a young girl comes in to kind of help with that and basically become a housekeeper, a servant, in the meantime. And turns out this is, of course, not just any young woman. And this is a more or less physical manifestation of La Llorona. And it's only because of, you know, here's the interesting thing with this film. This is why I think this was a kind of real unique take on this, is it doesn't start like a horror film. It doesn't start like with any supernatural elements. It doesn't really start with any, like, the typical tropes of, oh, okay, now here's where the supernatural stuff comes in. And even when the moments come where you think, we're going to have a jump scare, or we're going to have a scary moment, or you're waiting for maybe the music, or you're waiting for something to happen that you would typically see happen in a horror film, you know, the character's about to do this, so you know this is coming next. It leads you right up to that, and then it just backs off. It's like, no, 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 no. That's not, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to do something different. And it does it a few times where you realize, oh, okay, they're trying something new here. And we're still going to get there. It's still going to be a pretty disturbing and unsettling experience. But it's not graphic. It's not gratuitous. It is just enough to say, like, here's what happens when someone going through this, through these feelings that they don't want to accept, that they actually don't even, that they deny. This is how that manifests itself. But now in a very real way, by this folktale becoming a reality. And that's where the leap happens. For the viewer, you've got to kind of go with that. But once you do, you see, like, this is actually kind of smartly put together. It's really well done. And it takes its time doing it. So you don't ever feel like, we're just breezing past this and it's not even really all making sense. It makes sense, but you got to stick with it. So in that regard, I was really surprised by this because I was worried that this was going to be just like straight, okay, we're going right into supernatural things and special effects. No, this really takes a whole different angle to get to this story. And part of it, I'm sure, is probably, hey, I want to tell this story that will bring some awareness to this real world issue, but also give you a little bit of the tension and the horror that comes with how this affects people on either side of it. The people who did it, the people who carried it out, or the people who suffered from it. And so, when you look at it that way, like, okay, this really has taken a whole new approach to this. And I don't think every horror film would really work this way. But this was a very unique take on it. So it's a recommendation for me. And, you know, I'm only a little ashamed that I didn't see it a long time ago, or I say a long time ago, but years ago when it was making the festival rounds. Because this story, the story of La Llorona itself is particularly, I don't know, it's just intriguing to me. It's a folktale that I heard about as a kid. And you've seen here and there in other cultures. And like I said, it manifests itself in different ways. There's different variations on the story. And, I just think it's something that I'm glad someone finally found a way to tell this story that isn't so formulaic. So that's a recommendation for me. That is La Llorona. That is 137. Now, here's another one that I'll just say in a very similar fashion, starts out as one thing, and you kind of expect it to be a certain type of movie, a certain type of story, and is actually much deeper, much more heartbreaking, and also ends up being a very different kind of movie than what you thought you were getting into. And that is 138, Hereditary.
Come on, Peter. Let's just sue it.
It's heartening to see so many strange new faces here today. I know my mom would be very touched and probably a little suspicious. My mother was a very secretive and private woman.
It's Grandma. You know you were her favorite, right? Even when you were a little baby, she wouldn't let me feed you because she needed to feed you.
She was a very difficult woman, which maybe explains me.
I recognize you from your mother.
What? Sometimes I swear I can feel them in the room.
Oh my God! What was that?
She isn't gone.
She had private rituals, private friends.
Who's gonna take care of me?
You don't think I'm gonna take care of you?
But when you die,
and she wasn't altogether there. At the end.
Mom? I don't like this. Dad, I don't like this.
What's happening?
Tina!
Don't you ever raise your voice at me! I am your mother!
Please,
Mom, what's happening?
Make it stop!
I just don't want to put any more stress on my family.
Now, I have to say, I did see Midsommar first. And if you're not familiar, Midsommar was another film that came out a few years ago. It's directed by Ari Aster. And this film was his first film. And I somehow skipped this one, went straight to that one. And that, as much as a disturbing experience as it was still, maybe part of it is because the story takes place somewhere else. And it's basically about, some American kids being thrust into this very odd and weird and disturbing culture, or let's just say cult. I looked at that film one way. This, on the other hand, this is about a somewhat typical American family, I say. A couple and their two kids, a teenage son and a younger, teenage daughter. And it starts off with the mother, the woman played by Toni Collette, which does amazing stuff here. Stuff that really, it gets you right in the gut. Some of the work that she does, some of the performing here is just off the charts. It starts with her character, her character's mother dies. So the beginning is a funeral. And I'll tell you, if you've listened to any previous episodes, you understand that really hits me in a very distinct and impactful way right now. And even some of the speech that she gives, and even some of the sentiments that are expressed, it hits home. And so watching this character go through this grief and the process of trying to deal with the loss, I feel it. And the way that Toni Collette plays this, it really comes across. Now, that's just the beginning of the film. This story really does go into places that are deep into what happens to family when tragedy strikes, and what happens to parents who lose connections with their children, and how do you try to resolve that? How do you try to find a way through that? That's all the deeper thematic stuff. On top of that, though, what you're seeing on screen is honestly some really disturbing shit. And so because there's a giant thing that happens in the middle of the film that really turns the whole thing into a whole new experience. So I won't spoil that as much as I want to talk about it. If you've seen the film, you know what I'm saying. If you haven't, you got to watch it, because there's something that happens that it is so jaw-droppingly shocking. I just sat there with my mouth open when it happened. And it takes everything that has been building in the first, part of the film and just launches it out into the atmosphere. And you just don't know where we're going next. And I'll say, by the end of the film, we definitely go places. It really gets wild. And it gets into some really dark and unsettling stuff. So it's definitely a recommendation from me. I'll tell you right now, we haven't even gotten very far in this, but out of all these films, this is the one that really, it hit me the hardest, and it is just the most impactful. So that's 138 Hereditary. I'm sorry, I want to talk about it more, but you know, you've seen the film, you know what happens, and I don't want to talk past that. I want to let you experience it. So check that one out if you have time. Okay, so these next two, here are the next two I want to talk about. This is a different pairing. We're going to jump back in time. We're going to go back to the 80s. And here we're going to look at some films by a couple of filmmakers that have gone on to do some really big and much better stuff. But we're going to jump back to 1983. And this is 139 on Film Streak. This is The Keep.
On June 3rd, Paramount brings you a motion picture event, The Keep. Presented at selected theaters in 70mm and 6-track Dolby Stereo. The Keep brings together no less than 14 Academy Award nominees and winners for technical achievements and special effects. Michael Mann directs this startling vision of mankind's ultimate challenge, The Keep.
This place.
No one knows for sure. You must not stay here.
Something has been released.
Something.
Did you find what you were looking for? Did you expect to find me?
What are you? Whatever kills us gets in anyway. Nothing we do, no security works.
Here's a film that I didn't even realize this was directed by Michael Mann. You know, Michael Mann has gone on and is really kind of one of the top filmmakers, American filmmakers, in terms of crime dramas and thrillers and that kind of thing. Very adult fare, you know, very mature subject matter about criminals and cops and, you know, the lives of the two and basically all the intricacies of those, right? So here's a look at something that, I mean, this was his second film. This was a film that takes place in World War II. It's about some Nazis who mistakenly uncover this tomb, this keep that houses this demon, I guess, that is kind of laid dormant for, you know, centuries or whatever. You know, the whole premise just seems so un-Michael Mann-like. You know, this religious, supernatural, horror-based story. And it seems clear now that, yeah, this really isn't his lane. You know, he never made another film like this. I think right after this, he kind of returned back to what he was doing or going towards with Thief, his first film. And went and did Manhunter, which has some elements of horror and suspense in it, but not something this far-fetched. And, you know, it's not to even say that this is a bad premise. You know, you can see there are touches of good ideas in here and some really interesting cinematic, let's say, depictions of what this demon and what this story, you know, could look like. I just think one, maybe 1983, it just, you know, the effects, the type of visuals that they were going for, it just really wasn't there yet. But also, you know, if you read a little bit about the history of the film and the making of it, clearly it was a little bit of a troubled, messy production. And I think that just comes across, you know, it feels messy. It looks messy. It sounds messy. I mean, even, you know, the audio and some of the editing is just really, it's not very tightened up. And so it's really hard to look past that, you know, when you're going for such a kind of high concept, fantastical premise, you got to have the other stuff nailed down, or it's really hard to kind of get there. And so here's one that, you know, I would say it'd be, you know, if I would have seen this back in the day, if I would have seen this when I was like 12 years old, I might have a whole different experience with this film and an appreciation for this film. But watching it now and with so much that has developed in terms of filmmaking and storytelling, this just really doesn't cut it. And so it's a pass for me. It's a real shame. I like Michael Mann's films. I like all the stuff he does. I like the style of the way he tells his stories. But this one, it's just not a good match. So that's a pass for me. I'm just going to move through that one fast. We're going to kind of get our distance and we're going to move on. Okay? So we're going to move on to 140 on Film Streak. This is Near Dark.
Your head from your shoulders.
Do it fast.
All right.
The time's wrong.
Woo!
No!
You might as well just kill me then, too.
Caleb Colton no longer belongs to our world.
We give him a week to see if we can call him one of us.
He belongs to hers.
But you have to learn to kill.
He belongs to theirs.
I don't want to kill.
He makes you kill tonight.
And they all belong to the night.
It's 3 hours short for a bus to get home. You help me out?
What are you on?
Believe me, I told you.
Just don't think of it as killing.
Evening.
Woo! Don't think at all. It's just something that you do night after night. It's only ever a question of how.
You're nervous? I would be too if I were you. Near Dark.
Could be your boys falling in with control.
Check out time.
Bought yourself some time, son.
Come on. God damn, this is my family. Let him go.
Near Dark. Pray for daylight. The night has its price.
Now, here's a film by Catherine Bigelow, who, of course, went on to do some interesting work and won Oscar for The Hurt Locker, first woman to win Best Director, which was, you know, much, much appreciated and much, much needed, but also much deserved. And, you know, I think this one is basically the story of a young guy who lives out in the Midwest, and he kind of runs into this band, this group of roving vampires that, you know, he builds a relationship with them, but it's a little bit testy, you know, they kind of don't bring him in, and then they do accept him. And then there's an issue of his family and the world, you know, the people they run into on their travels, and you know, how these kinds of people or these beings, let's say, can somehow survive in the real world. And for a film that came out in 1987, I feel like it does some pretty good stuff in here. And where you would think, oh, they probably would have cut corners on this type of story, or even like some of the effects, you know, the makeup work and all that. They try to do the best they can, and it comes off for the most part. Some stuff that's a little spotty, but, you know, the performance, I'll tell you what, here's the thing that really got me. The performances here, there are a couple of standouts, you know. Bill Paxton, the late Bill Paxton, he really pushes this character that he plays into some interesting territory that's playful, but it's also menacing. And it's something that I don't really feel like we really saw out of Bill Paxton in any other films, or at least none that I can think of. You know, a lot of times he either played like kind of like a good old boy, or just a very kind of angry kind of, you know, testy kind of guy. But here he's like just an actual delightfully disturbed villain. Lance Henriksen plays kind of the leader of this group, and he's just an interesting figure to me, because I feel like this character could have been so dour and so intimidating, and yet there's a little bit of a warmth, but also a little bit of a danger, and so he really gives it some range. And I think that's really interesting, because it could have been one note, but it does feel like this is a guy who is trying to keep these crazy vampire characters in line somewhat, but also he realizes that they live a very different type of life. And so he's trying to introduce Caleb, you know, the young man, into this life and what it means to be this. I would say, you know, this is the opposite for me of The Keep, right? If I had seen this movie when I was like 12, 15 years old, I would think this is probably pretty high up on my vampire lists, right? Haven't seen it now. I get why there's some appreciation for this film as kind of a vampire, not necessarily classic, but one of that string of films in the 80s that seems to have kind of lived on through nostalgia or whatever, you know, feelings people have about it. This is one that I actually have a appreciation for, even though I'm not familiar with it until now. And I'd say a lot of it has to do with production design, some of the filmmaking, but the performances are really what kind of nail this for me. You know, the main character, Caleb, is played by Adrian Pasdar. I didn't really have a feeling one way or the other about it. I feel like the character is a little too naive about a lot of things. And it's almost like, is this a world where nobody has ever heard the word vampire? I don't even know if it's really said in the film. I can't remember. But, you know, that's always a little bit of a problem, because it's like, well, that's the world we live in. If this is supposed to be in the real world, how's nobody ever heard of what? There's a good portion of this movie where this character doesn't realize what's happening to him, and doesn't realize why this girl bit him on the neck, and why he's feeling weird and getting sick and feels like he's dying. And then he feels like he starts to have the hunger or whatever. Yeah, it's like, guy, read a book, watch a movie. There's a thing called vampires. That's what you're becoming. So there's a little bit of that where I'm like, I'll give it to the movie, because I feel like I understand it's going for a bigger story to tell. The sense of like someone who's trying to find their place and where they belong and who they belong with, and spread across all these different characters. It's an interesting way to come at it. It's not so graphic in the horror film sense. It does have some violence in it, and it's more about some shootouts. And when they do have to feed, it gets a little bit, you know, it gets a little bit rough for some people. But ultimately, it's actually kind of, I would say, honestly, a little bit tame by, let's say, today's standards. But it's still an interesting watch. And there's some stuff in here that I want to watch it again and see if I pick up more and have an even deeper appreciation for it. So that's a recommendation for me. And Near Dark, it's one that I feel like I just don't know if people have really seen this film. That's a weird thing to say, I guess, but I feel like for me, it totally slipped under the radar. I had really never heard of this film until about a year ago. And so, you know, watching it now and in this context, I can actually look at it and see like, oh yeah, there's some good stuff in here. So in that respect, give it a watch, check it out. And so, all right. So look, hey, that's been another episode of Film Streak. Thanks for listening. Thanks for checking this out. You know, I've got some other horror movies on deck that we're going to talk about in the next episode. But these are the maybe the lighter fare. Not all of them are easy to watch, but we'll get into some heavier stuff, okay? But in the meantime, again, thanks for checking this out. Check out some past episodes or previous episodes. You can subscribe if you're just finding this on your Apple Music or whatever. Go to filmstreak.com. You'll be able to find other stuff there. You know what I'm even thinking about doing? I'm thinking about, so one of the things I do with this podcast, right? Every episode I talk about these films and I actually have a list that I put together. I started from the first episode, but I've been keeping a list on IMDb of every film, including my rating, including the, you know, the order roughly that they're in every episode. I've been thinking about sharing that and making that public because I feel like, well, if you've seen some of these films, maybe you have your own rating of it on IMDb. Maybe you want to add it to your list. Maybe that's a good way. Is that a handy way? Do people use IMDb like that? I don't know. But let me know if that's something you're interested in. Or, you know, hey, if you have some takes on these films or you have some other suggestions or other films maybe we could talk about here, just send that to comments@filmstreak.com. And I'll check that out. I'll read that. If you have some films that are something I haven't seen before, I'll put it on my list. I'll watch it. So, all right. Until next time, take it easy and keep watching those movies.